Now let's welcome tonight's speaker, Kathleen W.
Hi, my name's Kathleen and I'm an alcoholic. I want to first of all thank Denny for asking me to speak because I feel like it's a big honor to speak in AA. And I'll tell you why. Because when I first got here, I frankly wanted nothing to do with staying here for a very long time. I wanted to get the heat off. I wanted to not get dumped by my, I'm an actress, by my agents. They were going to drop me. And I wanted to get the, I had a DUI and I didn't do what they had required regarding picking up the trash and going to the alcohol class. And it just felt like everything just kept mounting on me. Anyway, here I am, newcomers, I'll be 23 in December 16th, and I find that incredible because I'm not like a joiner person. I've never been, nor did I ever plan on staying here when I first got here. I just wanted that freaking court card signed to get the heat off. So anyway, let me just tell you about what happened to me. I'm born and raised in Santa Barbara, California, and I come from surf culture. And my family, I'm the youngest of five. They're all beach people. And I came out freckled, and I was a drama dork. And my family, they talk like this, and they're just very casual, and it's just everything's cool. And my sister used to tell me, God, Kathy, you think too much. Oh, my God, just relax. And that's the truth. I think too much. That's part of it, you know. And I'm not saying that turned me into an alcoholic. I'm just saying that was something that's just true for me. Now, to 23, I'm going to skip a little bit, but 23 years later, I have a bunch of sponsees, and I work this program on a daily basis so that I can have a daily reprieve from alcoholism because, you know, my mom died from alcohol, being an alcoholic, and I feel so incredibly grateful today for my sobriety. That's really why I do it. Otherwise, I'm actually afraid to drink. Like the life that I have today, I got this nice husband, I got these three kids, and I feel like if I took a drink, it would just be gone. That's something for me. Now, what I do in the morning, I roll out of bed, I hit my knees, and I pray, and I do like the third step prayer. I kind of do a mix between the third step and the seventh step. But basically, I have to screw my head on straight in the morning, or I am cruel. I yell to my children. I gotta have my coffee. I gotta screw my head on straight. So I pray, and I pray hard to bring God into the mix. Anyway, then I get my coffee. I go to my computer and I read AA stuff. So that I pull a little bit out of it and I email it to my sponsees. So I think it was the other day I was reading and I came across this and I thought, man, that I relate so much to that. I'm gonna read it to you guys. This is Bill Wilson. This is from A Language of the Heart. And he said, as a child, I had some pretty heavy emotional shocks. There was a deep family disturbance. I was physically awkward and the like. Of course, other kids have such emotional handicaps and emerge unscathed, but I didn't. Eventually, I was oversensitive and therefore overscared. Anyhow, I developed a positive phobia that I wasn't like other youngsters and never could be. At first, this threw me into depression and thence into the isolation of retreat. But these child miseries, all of them generated by fear, became so unbearable that I turned highly aggressive, thinking I never could belong and vowing I'd never settle for any second-rate status. I felt simply I had to dominate in everything. Everything I chose to do, work, or play. As this attractive formula for the good life began to succeed, according to my then specifications of success, I became deliriously happy. But when an undertaking occasionally did fail, I was filled with a resentment and depression that could be cured only by the next triumph. Very early, therefore, I came to value everything in terms of victory or defeat, all or nothing. The only satisfaction I knew was to win. All right, so I'm going to open my little talk here with that. Because, boy, do I relate to that. And the thing that I found as a kid was I like to sing and act, right? So that is what I filled my confidence bucket with, like singing and acting. Yay for you. And whenever anything threatened that, I felt like dying. And when I discovered alcohol, I didn't feel like dying so much. I forgot. I forgot that that was the rule that I played. Those were the rules that I played with. And I guess I was like, I just kind of started out, I'm the youngest of five kids, and my brother was a big pot dealer and surfers and partying. My childhood kind of looked like the opening scene of Jaws without the shark. And we just hung out on the beach, and it was very mellow. But we got wasted. And so I learned to arm myself with a cigarette and a drink in junior high school. And that's how I learned to shut that voice down, that when I wasn't winning, just to get that cigarette and that cocktail. So as I grew up, I pursued the drinking, and I pursued the acting, like my life depended upon it, which it did. And it seemed to me in high school anyway that I was able to kind of coordinate the two, and I would do the play, yay, and then I would go party and be terribly ashamed of myself because I got blackouts. I believe that if I were not a blackout alcoholic, I wouldn't be standing before you. Blackouts scare the crap out of me because I also wasn't a quiet blackout. The guy who passed out in their house. I was a giant loudmouth, I say, with Christmas tree lights on my head. I apparently hit people. I had no morals whatsoever. Nobody was safe. They used to call me Killjoy in Nashville. So I was probably delightful to party with. Anyway, so that's what happened to me. And eventually, I crashed my car in California and decided California was the problem. I packed up my Jeep Grand Wagoneer and I drove to Austin, Texas, thinking that that was where the real people were. And people in California just don't understand me, man. Nobody's real. They're all fake. That was one of my big party lines. Only to land in Austin, Texas and find that I was, again, surrounded by losers. That's what I would say. It's not me. I'm just a loser magnet. That's what I tell people. And eventually, I crashed and burned in Austin, decided Austin was the problem. And by crashing and burning, I just mean I start out with a bunch of friends, and I burn each and every one until they all go away. That's just how I rolled. And then it was Austin that was the problem. I'm going to go to Nashville. So I go to Nashville. And then Nashville was where I met my professionals, I say. I hung out with a group of people that would wake up in the morning, we'd go to the bar, and we'd start drinking. And we drink all day and into the night. Then we pursue what I call, for me, cocaine, the antidote to blackouts. I decided, trying to figure it out. And it just makes me drink more and not act like such an idiot. And that was, I'm sure, again, that was where they originated the name Killjoy for my nickname. I started to eventually go through my old pattern, which was have a bunch of friends, and then I slowly alienate each and every one until finally I had this tiny little crew left, and I wake up one morning in Nashville, probably around the crack of 1 in the afternoon, And I come into the living room. There's a bunch of guys sitting there. And I see a dude. He's got a big gulp cup and a bottle of vodka. And he's pouring the vodka into the big gulp cup. Long stringy hair, tattooed sleeves. And I look at him. I'm like, dude, what a loser. You're drinking vodka out of a big gulp cup at 1 in the afternoon? It's so gross. You know, and I'm like barely from the whole night before. And he looked at me, he's got this stringy hair, and he like poofs it out, you know, and he's like, man, at least I ain't doing heroin. And I look back at him, and I'm like, he's perfect for me. I love him. I love this dude. So, I love a good bad boy, like a lot of us grew up all. And, so I marry this guy. I marry him. I sent out marriage announcements. Good news, bad news. Bad news is I'm not single anymore. Good news, I'm married. Woo! You know, and I was wearing like a red suede mini dress and my hair's all different colors. And I was full of, like, it was working for me, I thought, in my mind until like, I got an acting job. I come back. Dude is completely strung out. He's pawned everything I owned. Wow, this wasn't my best decision. And I whisk him away to Cumberland Heights, you know, I gotta get him sober. And then he busts out in like 2 weeks and I feel like I'm in a movie of the week. Like, we're gonna beat this thing. You know. We had to have been quite a sight. So I do what any normal alcoholic would do. I decide that Nashville was the problem and I need to bring him back to LA where there is no heroin. And within a week, probably, I don't know, like maybe 2 weeks, we hadn't been here for very long, and I'm doing my makeup in the bathroom and I hear like a thump in the living room, and I come out and he's rolled up into the bookcase. And I get that feeling that we get if you're ever around this type of thing, and I question my instincts. I'm thinking maybe he's just playing with the cat behind the books. And then I like roll over his shoulder and he's in like a full-on seizure and foam at the mouth. I called 911. Whoever that operator was, I did mouth to mouth, and I watched the life come back in his face like this. And then the cops come, and he gets up, and he's like, man, what did you do? You know, and I'm like, oh, my God, I can't take it. I got it. Cops come. We take him to the hospital, Cedars-Sinai. I tell them he's epileptic, and we get epilepsy medicine, and we come back to our little house on Dix Street, and a limousine pulls up, and it's time for me to go do a movie in New Jersey. So I get in the limousine. I decided I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm going to be one of those sparkly-eyed, freak, sober people I saw at some of those court card meetings. And the driver rolls down the window. He's like, you know, there's beer back there. And I say to myself, you know what, I'm just going to have one. I'm just going to have one here. I drink the beer. I had this like obsessive compulsive drinking thing where in a six pack was difficult. And I guess they're not in a six pack. They were lined up in the, I don't know. I lost count of my beers in the limo. I get on the airplane, lost count of my Jack and sodas. And I have swizzle sticks down my jean jacket. I get to New Jersey. I guess, you know, me actress, me hit mark, you know, they just kind of wheel you around back in the, good thing there was no like, well, who cares? Anyway, so, I say about like those, that didn't, it doesn't matter. So I, they take me to the hotel. I guess, who knows? I guess there was a meeting in the bar. And that's, I'm in a blackout at this point. Anyway, I blow it. And they fire me from this movie. They say I was a loose cannon the next day. And I got my 3 months of clothes walking through the hotel, and I'm done. I can't do it anymore. I can't. I don't want to be like my mom who, you know, my whole family, when I called them and said, I got fired from the movie. I don't know why I got it. They said, Just don't drive. You can drink as much as you want. Just don't drive. That's your problem. But you know what? My mom, she died. She was 68 when she died. And you know, when I was going through her stuff, I found all of these newspaper clippings about how she used to play the saxophone. About how she was like nominated for Cherry Queen in Beaumont. She's from Beaumont by Redlands. And I learned a lot about my mother after she had died. I didn't know she won awards for saxophone, that she was in all these jazz bands. I didn't know this, right? But it was alcohol. Alcohol killed it. I know my mom as the woman who makes dinner and passes out in her dinner plate. That's the lady I knew. I didn't know a saxophone player. I didn't know that. Anyway, it's these kinds of things that I said to myself, like, wow, alcohol it stole the light from her. She was like the girl, like we'd lift our feet up when she'd vacuum. You know, it's because she just like, she was so hungover the next day, you know, she made perfect breakfasts and vacuum and, you know, and I grew up just saying, man, I'm never going to be like you. And there I was, you know, fired from this movie, sitting in my house on Dick Street, my junkie husband, he's got underwear on his head with his hair out the legs, you know, he's smoking out of a hollowed out pen. And I'm sitting there and I was like, I don't want to go out like my mom. I'm just going to do the AA thing for a year. I'm just going to do it for a year. I'll do the stupid steps for a year. That's it. And then I drink. So I call central office. And I call central office. Nobody forced me. No intervention. I call central office. They said, go down to the log cabin. I go down to the log cabin. They said, talk about the last 5 days, I remember. And I raise my hand and I say, I'm Kathleen. And somebody's like, well, who are you? I'm Kathleen. Who are you? I'm an alcoholic. And I remember when they say, like, I'm an alcoholic. Tears. Just cry. Because to me, being an alcoholic meant that I was a loser. That I was like my mom. That I was like my brother, big coke addict. That I was like my sister. She was a big drunk that made an ass of herself all the time. We called her Kitty Dukakis or something. And I didn't want to be that. And so I just cried. I couldn't believe, I felt like the party was over. So if you're new and you walk in here and you're feeling like the party's over, I relate. That's what I felt like. But I also knew that these sparkly-eyed freaks knew how not to drink. And I didn't know anybody who knew how not to drink. So I decided to just do what they said. And I saw another person I worked with, a really nice girl, and she's like, I tell her, you know, I was like, listen, I gotta warn you. I will do the 12 steps. And I will stay here for a year, but I'm not gonna go to Italy and not have a glass of wine. I'm not going to go to Ireland and not drink beer. And so I have every intention of drinking and, you know, doing a little blow now and then. I want to do that. Never had a hot buttered rum, you know, and I was telling her all this. And she said, she said, that's great. Just do the 12 steps. Just do them. Do what I say. I was like, all right then. So I start. She was like, 90 meetings in 90 days, call 3 people in AA every day. I'm like, great, I can do that. So I'm going to 90 meetings in 90 days. Then I see our friend Jessica. And now I got a trudging buddy. She's a friend of mine, and she's funny. Now she and I are going, she's doing the same thing. So we're going to 90 meetings, and we're starting to find. Now here's the thing. When I got here, I thought it was like brainwashing, right? I was the guy, oh, AA is just brainwashing. But if you go to 90 meetings in 90 days, what you're going to find is you're going to find the meetings that you like. It's not brainwashing. It's kind of just like common sense. It's like if we go to a meeting, we don't like that. So the next week, we didn't go to that meeting. We went to another meeting. Anyway, what I ended up doing was I created 7 meetings a week with people I enjoy, with people I relate to. All right, so now I've got these nice meetings, and I'm raising my hand as a newcomer, getting chips, kind of like the applause, got to admit, that never hurt this, you know, narcissist like it. And I'm enjoying it, and then I discovered like the Tuesday night whatever meeting, and now I see cute boys, and now something's awakening in me. Like, oh my God, I'm alive! I like boys! What is that on my couch at home? You know? Because homeboy was not sober. So then I start going to double winners meetings and start figuring out what I'm going to do with my junky husband. And then I get to like the third step, and my sponsor's like, you do this third step prayer for 2 weeks, every morning, every night, and then we're going to get together. So I do this third step prayer. It is meaningless to me at the time. It was like, whatever, this archaic language, thy, whatever, love, power, God, you know. But I did it. And that's what I asked of my sponsor, just do it. Just, like, who cares? Just do it, because for whatever reason, I'm telling you, I stayed sober. And I never could stay sober more than about 3 days, and then I'd be drunk, like I'd start January 1st. Then by January 3rd, I feel sweaty and crappy, so I'm drunk till February, you know, like, I never could quit anything. I was just saying, like, I have never done anything for 23 years. Not marriage, nothing, you know, I've never. And sobriety is something that I just, this whole mentality, this guy Bill Wilson, he writes for people like us. If you told me I'd never drink again, I'd drink. If you told me I don't have to drink today, I didn't drink today. I didn't drink today. So I'm doing these steps. I get down on my knees at my sponsor's house. She holds my hand. It feels so embarrassing and awkward. And I say to her, I offer myself to thee, to build with me, to do with me as thou wilt. And when I get to relieve me of the bondage of self, this is just my story, I realized self. The bondage of self. I realized the gravity of what I was saying. I had been so bound up with self-loathing my whole life. Like, I don't, when I was looking through all those pictures at my dead mother's house, my baby pictures, I had X'd out my face on all of them with a Sharpie. Because I thought I was ugly. I thought I was unlovable and that I was ugly. And I, you know, on the few pictures that I've managed to see, I wasn't ugly. I was just a little kid. I wasn't ugly. I wasn't unlovable. And it wasn't until I came to AA that I found out these things about myself. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I meant it, weeping, and she's like, wow, that really got to you. And I felt like that was, for me, a bit of a spiritual awakening for me. Then she taught me how to do the fourth step. I had always been a life happens to person. My friend said that when I was drinking, she used to ask me, hey Kath, how you doing? And then wince. Because I'd like fire off like, and then this happened, and I don't know that, and I just, I don't know, you know. But we do this fourth step, and we discover causes and conditions. Or as we say in Studio City, we discover my part. Right? My part. What did I, if I'm pointing at you, three fingers back at me. I know if you're new, she's like, oh my bloody blah, three fingers back at me. I totally get that. But when you start doing this inventory, which seemed like crazy at the time, but I just muscled through it. My sponsor kept saying, it doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. Because we do this stuff all the time. It ain't going to be your first. You're not going to do one fourth step and be like, I get it. Because it's not part of a daily reprieve. A daily reprieve means we work these steps every single day. Every day. Why? Because it increases the odds that I'm not going to drink today. And I still know excellent people that seemingly work great programs, and I'm stunned when they relapse. Like, it still happens. It's not a natural state for me to be sober. I have to treat my alcoholism. I grew up watching people. The minute they felt a feeling or felt nervous, drown, get. That's what I grew up. That's what I know. That's what I know. Take a pill. And now, the minute I get uncomfortable, I'm like, Jesus, I gotta go to a meeting. Shoot, I like, you know what happens to me? I had this experience recently. I got in a fight with my friend. I have a complicated friend. And I got in a fight with her. I'm so mad. I felt like I nailed her. And then I'm lying in bed, and it's one of them. I can't sleep. I can't sleep. Flap the covers off. I go bat over to my stuff. I start doing my inventory. I drink my chamomile tea. And I get to my part. Because the truth is, if I accept people for who they are, I know people, I know my friends, if I remember who they are and I accept them for who they are, then my, like, thinking my diatribe, my yelling at them with the pointed finger, 5 minutes, 1 minute, never have I yelled even at anyone with a pointed finger, that no matter how well I construct my piece, did they say to me in response, "Wow, you got a point. You got a point there, sister." Anyway, I work these steps. I work them. And when I don't work them, because everything is an ebb and flow, I start yelling at my kids. I start feeling like Hollywood is unfair, which, like, when has it ever been fair? I start thinking that it's over for me. Like, the way my mind works when I don't work this program is excruciating. All I gotta do is wake up in the morning, pray, reach out to my sponsees, go to a meeting, and when a resentment crops up, do my inventory. At the end of the day, thank God for another good one, another graceful day, stacking it up. And the next thing I know, I got this marriage to, not the junkie, he ended up, he lived happily ever after. It's a good story. He's sober. Yay, Craig. But I got a nice Jewish boy husband. I got an 18, a 14, and a 9-year-old kid. All healthy, all full of love. All drive me nuts, but that good kind of nuts, you know. And I got an actual house with a picket fence. And I got a net so that when life doesn't work out my way, I go right back to what I know, which is just the training that I've learned in here, in AA. So, if you're new, I just close with this. You have a shot at having, like, people not ashamed of you, not disappointed in you, happy to hang out with you. These are things that we take for granted in AA that is such a gift. And I know if you're new, you know, like, man, I don't know if I'll ever get that. I'm telling you, I would not keep coming back to these meetings for 23 years if I didn't feel like I got this cool life. Thank you. All right, so I guess, is there some I read or? No, I guess we ask questions. Okay, so if anybody's got their, yeah, right there, perfect.
My husband is alcoholic.
Hi.
You mentioned that you have a really hard time putting together like a day or 3 days, you know, and it's what I often hear is that you eventually get to the
ground now. She's asking me how I ended up putting together time after, like, you know, trying to stay sober for a day, then getting 2 days, and then getting a day again, and then 3 days, and then, you know. Well, it took a while. My answer is it took a while for me to accept that alcohol was a problem because I kept getting record deals, and I got acting jobs. Like, it just that's part of my story, and I feel like that was part of the thing that kept me drinking. Because I remember, you know, early on, I had a boyfriend kidnap me when I was 18. Well, he didn't kidnap me, but he took me to an AA meeting instead of taking me out to dinner. I don't recommend, because I was pissed. And so it took me a while, because I felt like, I don't have a problem. You have a problem. I don't have a problem. I drink. I get drunk. So what? You know, it's like me on a roller coaster. I get on and I have this great time, and then I get off the roller coaster. You stay on the roller coaster and just go around and around and around and around. I remember saying that very thing to a chick at the AA meeting that he took me into. She was so cool, like long nails and, you know, tough, tough chick. And she's like, man, I hope you keep coming back. She's like, oh! Anyways, I had this hard time accepting that I was an alcoholic, which is the bottom line with when you, for me, when I would drink and then I decide, okay, that was a terrible bender. I'm not going to drink today. Nope, I'm not going to drink today. And then preceding every beer, or for me, vodka was my thing, were the words, I'll just have one. I'm not that, it's just a beer. Just a couple of beers. Who cares? I'll just have one drink. My one drink was me stumbling down on Santa Monica Boulevard, ending up at Trunks, coming back to my little house with the message light beeping 20 messages because I had asked people to be my housekeeper, which I didn't have at the time. So, like, I never knew where that drink was going to take me. So, to me, it wasn't until I made that call to central office, I made the call, I was done, hopefully, you know, that I surrendered and started to stack up those days. So I guess that's the long answer. The short answer is I wasn't willing to admit to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. And until I was willing to admit that, I was doomed to fail. So I hope that helps. I don't know. Sure, right there.
Mm-hmm. How were you able to tolerate that?
How was I able to tolerate my alcoholic husband? It was hard, I have to tell you, because first of all, it helped that he was very respectful about it. As I said, I can't have booze in the house or I'll drink it. That was the first thing. I took out all the booze in the house. But he was a junkie, like he was a drug addict. So that kind of helped. He wasn't drinking, because I think that would be difficult. But ultimately, how I was able to tolerate it was I started to immerse myself more and more in AA and picking and leaning, like my, I felt like I was being filled up socially, like the fellowship was working to, I wasn't depending upon him to fill my heart so much. I was depending upon, it shifted and I became more invested in the friendships I was making in the fellowship. So I was actually laughing more with the, you know, going out for coffee with the people in AA. I was finding a kind of joy that I hadn't known in this drunken, sort of miserable. We had a very sick relationship, my ex and I. And so the dichotomy was huge. I ended up going to double winners meetings and working a double winners program, which, you know, some people call it Al-Nazi or whatever, but I ended up working a kind of classic party line with my husband, which was by February 14th, I hope you get a 30-day chip or you're going to have to move out. I set that boundary. Every time I wanted to ask him, did you go to a meeting? Every time I wanted to do that, I called my sponsor. And she's like, hang in there, you know, but he's going to die. I know it. He's, I just like, and it used to kill me that I felt like he would think that I didn't think he was loaded. I always knew when he was loaded. And anyway, I just slowly started to work this kind of Al-Anon program so that when February 14th came around and he was loaded on the couch with no sobriety, it wasn't a fight. There was no fight. He knew what the deal was. I hadn't nagged him any at any point throughout that process. And I was like, dude, you're so not clean, so you're going to have to move. And he, I remember him saying, don't make permanent solutions to temporary problems. He was smart, right? Yeah, that was good. I was like, that's good, but you got to move out. You know? And the thing is that we anticipate, you know, these giant fights, but I had been working a program with God in the mix, praying for him one day at a time. For I'd given him 60 days to get a 30-day chip. And each day I knew that day was coming. And I'd see it, and I'd see that, you know, I never asked him if he was clean or sober. I never dragged him to a meeting. He'd see me going to the meeting. My sponsor's like, it's not your responsibility. It's between him and his God. He has his own higher power. And I remember her saying, because I had a BMW at the time, and I remember her saying, he's going to die in your BMW just as fast as he's going to die in the gutter in the street. And I, that's really true. Anyway, I kicked the guy out of the house, and within 2 weeks he calls me. He's like, guess where I am? Brotman Hospital. And he's been sober ever since. So, you know, I put him in through 3 treatment centers, you know, Nashville, Betty Ford, and another one in Nashville. It never worked. It wasn't until for him he admitted to his innermost self that he wanted this program. And what's beautiful, the dude has a great life today. He's got 2 kids, he's a great wife, he loves AA. It works, this program, if you just swan dive into it. But you gotta be ready to do it. And if you don't want it, you know, what do they say? They'll refund you your misery. But it's really hard, because here's the bottom line. I know people, great people, who refuse to work the steps. And they go out and they die. It's awful. And I wish that it was a rare thing, but it's happened a lot. Way more than I would ever have dreamed, you know, coming in here. That's another reason we hang on to each other. Somebody, you know, the guy in my meeting, his dad used to bring him to the meeting. Oh, he was such a great dude. And he died. He died on the operating table for not a major heart. It was a heart operation, but no one expected him to die. And we hung on to this dude. We were heartbroken about his dad dying, and so we knew, like, it gets precarious. Death is the front lines. Cause you can say, like, how is there a God? You know, I used to say with my mom, you know, when people talk about the God's path, right? Well, why did my mom have such a terrible path, you know? How can that, you know, stand in children's hospital and talk about God's path, you know, that's what I'd say to my sponsor. But when you start thinking about God, for me, when I started thinking about God as being the magic of love between myself and my friends, and the creativity and the smile, laughing kid, my kids when they're laughing and things are beautiful, boy, did I go off on a tangent. Love AA. Okay, anybody else question? Sure, right there. Pardon me?
What advice would you offer about finding a sponsor?
Oh, I say don't be too picky. Because nobody's perfect, you know what I mean? And I say, and like, if somebody doesn't work for you, find another one. I also sponsor with really loose arms. If it doesn't work, if somebody doesn't hear my message, then find someone whose message you hear. I don't fire anybody, you know, but I also feel like I have like my own sort of thing where I find out how committed somebody is to the program, because I feel like it's important that we don't co-sign people's, I don't want to get into a mean mommy, bad teenage girl thing that can happen with, I think, female sponsors and sponsees. I don't like getting into that dynamic. And when I get into that, I'm not being a service. So I feel like for me, when they say like temporary sponsors and you look and you see the people raising their hands, just pick one. They did the steps. They're all, you know, we all kind of do them, like there's variations, but it's the same old theme, it seems, you know. And then if you feel like it's not, and somebody's giving you something that you feel like is not, like doesn't sound like AA, or it's not in the big book, then find somebody else. But I think people, I had somebody come up to me and they say, I want to get your number, I'd love for you to sponsor me. I said, sure, of course, you got to call me every day for 7 days and then we'll start talking about the book. That's what I do, right? And she's like, whoa, I'm asking three other people and then I'm going to pick. And I'm like, you know, I'm not auditioning, like, you go with those other two guys or whatever. Because I don't want, you know. Like, what? I'm not going to audition to be a sponsor. You know, a whole life of, you know, auditions. I ain't going to do it in this room. This is sacred ground. So, you know, for me, I think people get into, like, a trap of being too picky. Just pick someone. Now, that would be my answer to that. Right there.
Yeah, thank you very much. Talk about, you know, you've got all the goodies bag, you have your life, kids, everything else. What are you doing
He's saying, what do I do now to stay close and to give back to the program? Well, I go to regular meetings on regular meeting days. And I'm a part of the Not Saints group. It's a women's group in Studio City. I sponsor about 8 girls, give or take. There's a couple of them that, you know, how we do. Loose arms, I say. I wake up every morning. I pray. I send off my emails to my girls. I usually start my day with a meeting. I go to 9 o'clock on Monday, 9 o'clock, Moore Park, Tuesday. Then Friday I go to Colfax, Saturday I go to the Not Saints group, and Sunday I go to the Palisades speaker meeting. So those are the meetings that I regularly hit. And then if I got a Tuesday opening, I go to the Tuesday Not Saints group. Wednesday opening, I go to the Wednesday Moore Park at 7:30. And Thursday, there's a women's meeting, Not Saints group, at 1 o'clock at Dickens and Tyrone. So these are the meetings that I go to. Regular meetings, regular meeting days, sponsor people. I think that's, for me, one of the main... At 17 years of sobriety, I was making beer bread from the recipe at the Trader Joe's. I'm making beer bread. I'm good in my sobriety. I'm speaking. I'm the treasurer, which I love because I never like to trust me with the money. I love AA, right? And I got the sunlight of the spirit. I'm making beer bread, stirring. I go in the garage, get one of my husband's, a normie, and I get one of his beers, and it's hot outside, and I hear that sound, the bubbles, and I'm like this, here's the bowl, here's the beer, and I'm like, no one would know, I could have one sip, so that's how tricky, cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease is. Pour the beer into my beer bread and dump the rest out into the sink, and was kind of dramatic and ceremonious about it, because I chose not to, but it was such an amazing moment, because that's how easy it is. Nothing was wrong. I wasn't going to drink over anything. Just that sound. And the smell, right? I always tell my husband when he drinks beer, I'm like, you smell like seventh grade. You know. But that's why I feel like it's, that's why we're still here. And some of my sponsors are like, I remember I had this friend of mine up in Laurel Canyon, and he's an alcoholic. And sometimes I just talk, he asks me about AA, and he's like, man, you go to that thing for 20 years, you must be the grand poobah by now. It's like, but we're not, there is no grand poobah. We just come one day at a time. Like, you know what I mean? Cause there's been great people I've known that you're like, you're surprised their hand goes up at newcomers. Like, we can't judge those people. I can't judge those people. I can't. It could happen just with a flick of the wrist, done, out, starting on day one, you know. That's how tricky it is. That's how, why I hang on to this thing so tightly. I don't want it. I don't want my kids to have a drunk mom. It broke my heart watching my mom drink and to see how it turned out for her. What might her life be like if she had come to AA? I'm sure a lot of us are sitting there thinking that with our alcoholic parents. You know, this is a family disease. I come from a long line of town drunks. Really. Right there. Right. How do I talk to my kids about my sobriety and meetings? Well, I'm not the greatest parent in the world, so just know that. I don't have a lot. I'm working on boundaries, and it's a struggle. I never had any kind of affront with my kids that I, you know, like I know some people like break the news to their kids when they're in junior high. My kids were being dragged to AA meetings really early, and so I tend to think that it's not, I didn't like to bring them, they're old now, you know, 18, 14, and 9. But they give me a cake every year because I'm proud of it. I'm proud that I'm a sober mom. And sometimes that is enough to keep me from drinking in a day. I'm so proud of that because I grew up with a drunk mom and it was single-handedly the most tragic thing to me as a kid. Seeing her like that, she embarrassed me in the Girl Scouts and talked to me while I was on stage. Hi, Kathy! Hi! You know, my brother's like, Wilbenheimer! And I'm just like, oh my God, and everyone's laughing. You know, I felt like I came from the drunky drug family, you know. And, you know, I laugh about it now, but I had so much shame about it. And I look at my kids and, you know, they're like, Mom, so-and-so thinks you're the cool mom, you know, like it fills me. And I'm not just, I'm, you know, now they think, I have teenagers, they think I'm the biggest dork that ever lived. But, you know, but that's how I do it. You know, I remember I wanted this part, I thought it was going to save me, just like I read here. I thought this one part was going to save me. I wanted to be the Calamity Jane in the show on HBO, right? I wanted to be a cowgirl, right? And I wasn't even close on this part. I was so disappointed. But I knew that, like, it's just disappointment. It's just, that's okay. So I ended up on my front lawn with tears in my ears, like, oh, I just really wanted this one. And my son comes out, and he's like, oh, Mommy, it's okay, it's okay. I was like, just really disappointed. I'll be fine, just disappointed. You know, I love you, Mommy. I love you, Mommy. You know, so, and then I felt horrible. I'm like, I'm the worst mom in the world. You know, my Calgary, and you know, my kid, he's 18 now. He grew up to be such an awesome dude. Who, like, he's empathetic and he understands, like, I don't know what I, you know, outside, this is who I am. And I'm freaking proud of being an AA. I love it. I love the people here. Wrap it up. I got the hook from Denny. So that's it. Thank you.
I'll talk forever about it.